You know, I was glad this morning as I was getting ready for the day that it was a little bit warmer. We were starting to put coats on in the cookhouse, and everybody was wondering which of these like heavy winter coats we're going to bundle up on. All through the week, it was just bitter cold, right? It's like, boy, this winter came early this year, and I am not here for it, even though I technically am here for it. And so we all have our different coping mechanisms for how we're going to try and get through the cold days. I found myself one of the nights this week on our couch scrolling through the Photos app, looking back to the summer, looking for days that were warmer in the hope of like looking at summer pictures might in some way start to warm me up a little bit. And one of the sets of pictures I came to was last summer we took a trip up to South Dakota and we were in the Badlands National Park hiking around. We had a great time. And one of the trails we came to was called Notch Trail. And Notch Trail has this like ladder thing. It's like a rope ladder, but way bigger. If you've been to Turkey Run ever and you've done the ladder trails there, it's kind of like that, except even bigger. And so we came to the trail, Notch Trail, with this like, it's like timbers with, instead of ropes, like the like heavy duty wire type things. And we go up to the top, our whole family, and we got to the top, we're like, wow, that was a little more intense than I thought we were signing up for. But we're up here, so let's enjoy, you know, this upper section and see what our options are. And we got up there and we realized after we got up, the way we got up is the only way down. There's not a way to walk back around, right? And so a challenging hike up, or a climb up rather, is even a more difficult climb back down. And it was a little scary for us, honestly, because we got up to the top and my youngest, Grace, was 7 at the time. She had just broken her arm a couple of weeks earlier, so she's got this cast on. She can't really grip the, like, the timbers were going up. And to go up, like the steps were kind of far apart, and so you could step up, but going down, if you can't reach the step going down and can't grip the little timber, that's, it's a scary deal, right? And so we got up there, and we're kind of envisioning all of this, and we didn't know what we were going to do, and we just sat down on the rocks, like, we made it, and I don't know what we're going to do, because I wish there was a different way down here. This is going to be difficult. In fact, I think we have a picture of this that to show you. You could sort of see there, like at the bottom, we're on our way up, and I'm taking this picture from the bottom. But by the time you get to the top, it's not like a gentle incline. You're just going up the face of this cliff. And so on the way down, I guess you can tell we made it back, okay? That's the good news. I went down first, and then our older two daughters went next, and then Emily and Grace came down at the end. And what you can't really see on this picture, but if we would zoom in, you could, is Emily was like holding onto the rope, and Grace was like in front of her on the ladder, like a kangaroo. Is that how kangaroos would do that? I think that's how kangaroos would do that. And so she would kind of go down a step and like latch onto Grace, and Grace would go down, and they were just, I mean, it took a long time, and there was a whole body of people waiting for us to be done once we got done, but we made it. Up at the top, though, we were realizing, boy, this would have been a lot better if there was a simpler way down of this. But the only way up, the only way down was this one singular ladder. There was no other option. Mark 9 is saying a very similar kind of story about there's only one way to do this. There's only one way to come to Jesus, and it's through faith. And maybe you would wish there was a different way. Maybe another way might seem easier to you or simpler, but there is no other way. The only way to come to Jesus is through faith. He's saying, you can't work your way to me. You can't sweet talk your way to me and tell me all the good things you did on this life. You can't repeat enough positive thinking to get yourself to Jesus. There's no other way but through faith. And if you think of the story, you've got the demon-possessed man and his dad who come to Jesus in desperation, and their desperation is a mark of their faith. And you have the disciples who cannot cast out the demon, and Jesus says, it's because you didn't pray. You were trusting in yourself, not in me. You didn't have faith. And Jesus says, anything is possible for the one who believes. And that word believes in the Greek is the exact same word as faith. Anything's possible for the one who has faith. So the main thing I want you to hear this morning is actually very, very simple from Mark chapter 9. It's simply this. Faith is the only bridge from our frailty to Christ's fullness. Faith is the only bridge from our frailty to Christ's fullness. Maybe you love the idea of trusting Jesus, and you've built your life on it. And maybe you're still grappling with the claims of Jesus, whether you want to trust him or think he can be trusted. And I would just tell you, it did not matter in South Dakota when I was at the top of that hill if I liked the path down being only one of this ladder. It was the only way. The only way to Jesus is through faith. And so we should come to grips with that reality, wrestle with our souls, wrestle with him, and place our trust in him. What I want to do this morning is to work phrase by phrase through this main idea and show it to you from the passage and think about how we apply it to our lives. A quick background may be helpful. I know some of you are here for the kids program and you're not always in town or at Parkside. The first part of Mark chapter 9, Jesus is up on a mountain. He takes Peter and James and John. It's the transfiguration. It is a once-in-a-lifetime spiritual high. They were literally on the spiritual mountaintop. And they come back down to the bottom, and they find lots of people arguing. People are swarming Jesus, presumably wanting him to, you know, answer their silly argument and resolve the matter. And he comes down, and he says, what are you guys arguing about? You get the idea. He's exasperated and a little exhausted. It might be like during Christmas Day, you have all the presents and everybody's happy, and then the kids run off and they get into this heated argument about whose sippy cup got used by the other child. That's my cup, that's my cup, that's my cup. Grandpa, you fix it. It's like, guys, like we just had Christmas Day. It was like the best day of the year. Like, do we have to argue right now? Maybe that's how Jesus feels coming down off the mountaintop and everybody has an argument that he wants to enter into, or maybe he doesn't want to enter into. But as they're figuring out about this argument, the guy yells out and says, well, heal my son. He has this great need. The disciples can't do it. And Jesus immediately knows why the disciples couldn't do it. They didn't pray. This kind can only come out by prayer. It was a marker of their lack of faith. They were trusting in themselves. They thought they had the thing made. They'd lost sight of the power source. And here's Jesus' response to them. Look at Mark 9 and verse 19, he says the following, and he answered them, O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. It's almost as if Jesus says, I've done miracle after miracle, healing after healing, feeding after feeding. I've even raised the dead, and you guys are still trying to do this on your own. What will it take for you to trust me and not trust yourself? He says, oh, faithless generation. Do you hear the exasperation in his voice? Why is he so exasperated? I think this is really critical for us to see. Because unbelief and a lack of faith is no small thing. In fact, unbelief and a lack of faith will send you to hell. And in the American church, I think we have become very okay with the idea that hell is reserved for the worst of the worst, the moral monsters. We've come to the grips with this idea that hell is reserved for terrorists like Bin Laden, or abusers like Diddy, or mass murderers like Hitler. That's who hell is reserved for. But hear me very clearly on this. The path to hell is marked by well-intentioned, moral people who simply don't trust in Jesus. That's so important for you to understand. The path to hell, and I say this with all sincerity and sobriety of heart, mind, and soul, you need to hear this. The path to hell is marked by well-intentioned, moral people who simply have not put their faith in Jesus. So I want to start at the point of faith. That's the main idea of what I said. Faith is the only bridge from our frailty to Christ's fullness. Let's talk through faith just a little bit here. Faith is the only bridge. On the one hand, faith sounds sort of easy, but when you come to actually think about it, sometimes it's quite hard. When I think about my own problems, you think about your problems, whether it be a relational challenge, whether it be a financial challenge, whether it be fears or anxieties you're carrying, it's often easier to try and fix it myself than to trust Jesus. It's often easier to talk to somebody else about my problems than to take them to Jesus and trust him. It's often easier to distract myself with food or pleasure or watching something or social media. All that's easier than trusting Jesus. And why is it that faith is so difficult? Because the core concept of faith is what we call trust. Those two words in the biblical language are very closely knit together, faith and trust. And our modern world has this idea of faith like a leap of faith, like I'm going to jump off the platform in a leap of faith and hope that God or some, you know, divine spaghetti monster catches me or something. That's how our modern world thinks of faith. But that's not how the Bible talks about faith. It's not a leap of faith, it's trust. There's kind of three components to biblical faith that we want to think about. There's one, a recognition of facts. So if I just use this stool for an example, there are facts about what makes this thing up, whether it's metal or hard plastic, whether there's a kind of a fake leather top to it. There are facts that are required for faith. Maybe I read about them in the owner's manual. And more than a recognition of facts, faith requires me, secondly, to actually agree that the facts are true, that the manufacturer actually made the thing out of what they said it made it out of. It's not just an acknowledgement here, but a belief that they're true. And then even that is not enough. I could tell you all sorts of things about this stool, believing they're true, and yet I've not exercised faith until I've sat down and placed my weight on the stool. I'm now trusting it. I must know the facts, have a real belief they're true, and entrust myself to that. Biblical faith is trust, not a leap of faith like our modern world likes to think of. And the Bible says that faith is not just one good thing among many. Faith is the thing. Ephesians 2:8, by grace you have been saved through faith, through trusting in Jesus, not trusting in yourself. It's not of works, Ephesians 2:9 says, so that no one can boast. I can't boast about holding myself up on this stool. The stool holds me up, not me. That's why it must be through faith. Hebrews 11:6, without faith, it is impossible to please God. That is strong language, friends. You cannot please God without faith, without fully trusting in him. And so long as I just know facts about God or even believe that they're true, I've not yet exercised faith. Faith is how one is saved. And I wonder if you're here this morning, you've come to church for years or perhaps just off and on, and you can tell me all sorts of facts about Jesus, and you even think that many of them are true. But you've not entrusted yourself to Jesus. You're walking with a lot of knowledge, but not actual faith. You may not even be a Christian, even though you would own that label, because you're not trusting in Jesus. Christianity, friends, is at the core not about good things you do, but about the perfect life that Jesus lived. You are not trusting in your own good deeds, but in his perfect deeds, his perfect righteousness, his perfect life. And faith alone is how you become a Christian, but it's also how you walk as a Christian. Right? It's both and. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 12, Paul would write that you should fight the good fight of faith. In other words, it's difficult to keep walking by faith. It's a fight to walk by faith and trust Jesus in the midst of hardship and difficulty. It's difficult, maybe even harder, to trust Jesus in prosperity, because it's easy to see the hard work I put in, the extra hours I worked, the ways I invested in that relationship. Fight the good fight of faith, Paul says. Ephesians 6, he says, in all circumstances, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish the flaming darts of the devil. Take up the shield of faith. I'm not trusting in me. I'm trusting in Jesus. And as I take up that shield, that's how Satan's attacks are defeated. I'm no longer trusting in myself, but in Jesus. Have you ever thought about what your own proverbial shield of faith might be? Difficulty comes. What's the shield you go to? Problems come. My shield is ChatGPT. Question come up, they can give me every answer. My shield is a bowl of ice cream. Problems come up, I hold up that shield, I can get through anything if I've got ice cream on the other side. My shield, when problems come up, is alcohol. Any problem comes, it'll help me to forget about it. Friends, we have all kinds of proverbial shields we use to get through our days. Are you taking up the shield of faith, Ephesians 6:16, in all circumstances? Faith is the only bridge from our frailty to Christ's fullness. Jesus comes down the mountain and he makes two very interesting comments about faith. The first one is negative when he says this faithless generation, this unbelieving generation. And the second one is at the end of the passage where he talks about prayer. He says this kind of demon is only cast out in prayer. Look at verse 29 with me. Here he's giving a positive statement. Here's what faith looks like. This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. In other words, the thermostat in a room tells you the temperature of the room. And the thermostat of your faith is your prayer life. It tells you if you're actually living in faith or just talking about faith. The disciples saw all around them this evil, this demon, and they underestimated it. And they overestimated themselves. The evil out there is not so bad, we can conquer it. The power in us is pretty great, we got it handled. This is the very definition of not walking by faith. We can do this. And you see them living it out. I do think it's very fascinating here in Mark chapter 9 is the first positive command in the entire Gospel of Mark towards prayer. Wouldn't you expect that earlier? We're like more than halfway through the Gospel. And nowhere have we been commanded to pray yet. I think the reason for that is because Mark knows that identifying your power source in whom you trust is far more important than tactical instructions in how to pray. Most of the time, when you buy electrical devices, they don't give a ton of instruction on how to plug the outlet in. They assume you've already got confidence in the power source. And Mark has spent the first 8 chapters saying, who is Jesus? He's the power source. Get that straight and you'll realize I must come to him. As Frederick Bruner, theologian, said, and I love this simple little quote, it's so helpful for us, prayer is simply faith breathing. I must have more of Jesus. I must have his help. I cannot do this alone. So what I mean, friends, is not so much as to say you need to pray for an extra 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 minutes at the beginning of your day and then move on, but I must have daily prayer, hourly prayer, minute-by-minute prayer, second-by-second prayer, as I trust in Jesus every step of every day, or as Ephesians 6 would say, in all circumstances. You might think of it this way. You come home at night, your Christmas lights were on when you left, you get back and they're not on, and you try to figure out, what are we going to do about this? And you start to assess the problem, and you see that they're not plugged in. Somebody's pulled a prank. Good for them. And your decision is not to go plug them back in, but to go to the Lowe's store because you wanted a different kind of bulb, and maybe that would help it to turn on if you had different bulbs. So that doesn't make sense. That's obviously backwards, right? Yes, Mark knows that quite precisely. Once you know the power source must be established, the bulbs are downstream from that. And I think far too often in our Christian lives, for those of you who are Christians, we're thinking about tactical strategies. What's the Bible study I should be in? Which translation of the Bible should I read? What's my evangelistic tactic or strategy? Which church might I be at? All good and helpful questions. But aside from faith and trust in Jesus Christ, those lights are never going to turn on. Have we gotten fixated on replacing the light bulbs in our Christian life and lost sight of the fact that the power cord is not plugged into Jesus. We're not living in active faith and trust. And we often think of faith in terms of like big faith, strong faith, heroes of the faith, prayer warriors. But the biblical markers of faith are not its size and strength and amazingness, but its desperation, its smallness, its weakness. Jesus compared faith to the smallest of all seeds, the mustard seed. Here in Mark 9, you see the man coming in desperate faith, even filled with doubts. He says, I believe and help my unbelief. He didn't have it all worked out. This is one of the hallmarks of biblical faith. You don't yet have it worked out. In church history, they would call it this, faith seeking understanding. I trust you, and I'm still learning more about how you sustain me. I want to understand more. Faith is not opposed to seeking science, knowledge, or understanding. It's in favor of all of those. It's faith seeking understanding. Maybe you think of it this way. I was a number of years ago, led a missions trip to Los Angeles. And I made a grave error. It was during the summer. I left my water bottle in the car. Actually, it was a 15-passenger van we were driving around. And come to think of it, I'm a little thirsty now. So I leave the water bottle in the van. And we go out and we do whatever we were doing in the city that day. And by the middle of the afternoon, I'm pretty thirsty. But I've got no water bottle. And so we're off doing what we're doing. We get back to the van and I pick up the water bottle. And I'm essentially hangry at this point. Like, I am very parched. If people are asking me questions as we get close to the van, I did not hear the questions our students had. I was fixated. I have to get this water bottle, right? And if I open the van door and pop somebody else's car, I may not even feel that bad about it today, even though I probably should, because I was focused on getting my water. And I got to the water bottle, and of course, in the middle of Los Angeles, in the middle of a summer day, baking in the van all day, this water is hot to the touch. I take the lid off, and I drink it, and it hurts my mouth. It's so hot. And yet, it was so satisfying. Because I was desperate. I have to have water. Of course, I wish it was cold or at least room temp, but it's like 100-degree water, and I'm still drinking it. It's kind of like splashing down my face. It's kind of ugly, probably, and I didn't care at all because I found my water. That's how the Bible describes desperation for I need Jesus every moment of every day. If I look a little ugly or unkempt in getting to him, I don't care. Because I'm more concerned about getting to him, the only source of hydration, than keeping up the appearances for others to see me looking good. I need Jesus. And I'll just tell you guys, when you have pursued Jesus with this kind of relentless desperation in the middle of your day, that's what worship looks like. Oh, Jesus, you are the only one. You are the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through you. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Psalm 16:11. I need more of you in my life. That's where you worship. And you also worship while you sing. Worship is all of life. And it's the overflow of abundance, of desperation for Jesus. And what often happens is it's so easy to try and carry our daily burdens and anxieties, our daily stressors, our daily responsibilities, and they weigh on us. And if you carry them yourself without leaning fully on Jesus, friends, you will not experience the abundant life he intends for you. Faith is the only bridge from our frailty to Christ's fullness. The only bridge. Let's move to that next middle part. It's not only the only bridge, but it's from our frailty. Right? Faith is at the core of the passage, and we started there. But I do think this passage shows us a striking realism. It shows us the recognition that living as a human being on planet Earth is really hard sometimes. And I, for one, am thankful that the Bible doesn't only show us the good days. It also shows a very real, boots-on-the-ground picture of the day-to-day grind. In this passage alone, frailty shows up all over the place. There's arguments ruling the day. There's a man who is demon-possessed. You may not see a ton of demon-possessed people in your daily life, But certainly in this area, we're experiencing a huge mental health crisis, are we not? I'm not saying those are the same. They're not the same. But perhaps you see it, the frailty manifesting itself in a similar way. You've got a dad filled with doubt, wants to do the right thing, wants his son to get to Jesus, still kind of questioning if it's all real. You've got disciples that are power depleted. They used to be able to do great things for God, and now they feel like they've got nothing to bring to the table. Maybe that hits you at home today. Like, Jesus, I remember when I was on fire for you, and I was praying all the time and reading my Bible and telling people about you, and it was like it was exciting to give to the Christmas offering or whatever the next thing was. I had so much joy in that, and now I just feel like hamstrung. Like these disciples, I feel power depleted. Let's just walk through these guys one at a time and see our frailty showing up here. The demon-possessed guy, passage doesn't tell us his age. It says the demon possession started when he was a child, but we don't know exactly how old he was. Look at verse 21 of Mark 9 with me. Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood." Boy, isn't that significant to see who Satan is targeting? Satan is preying on the young and the weak, these awesome little kids that just got to sing to us. Satan is targeting them. And he targeted this guy here in Mark 9 from a young age. He doesn't wait until K-5 to begin spiritual warfare on them. He's more than happy to hit below the belt. Friends, we must recognize this and invest in the next generation, recognizing there's a spiritual battle for their souls. It's easy to think of, like, how does spiritual warfare hit the adults in the room? How does it hit the three-year-olds? Pray for them. Get your member prayer guide out. It's the second most important book I own behind the Bible. And for you as well, pray for the children of our church. Satan's not taking days off. And look at verse 20. I love this. Who brings the boy to Jesus, the man to Jesus? There's no name you'll find there in verse 20. It simply says, they. They brought him to Jesus. Plural. I think the implication there is discipleship is a community project. Mom and dad, first disciple makers. You bet. We need you to own it, to step up, and to lead your family spiritually, especially dads. But we also need to see that discipleship is a community project. And that's why I'm so thankful. I pumped up our children's ministry workers a few minutes ago. They're not doing childcare. They're not doing babysitting. They're actively engaged in discipleship. Did you hear how those kids crushed their memory verses? That was awesome. We need more of that. Let's stick with it together, guys. And I want you to recognize the frailty in this passage. Satan and his hosts want more than difficult lives for you and for this church, for the world. They don't merely want difficulty, they want destruction. Look at verse 22. Verse 22 says it very plainly. It has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. Maybe you've not been cast by a demon into fire or into water, but this desire for destruction of you and your soul and your family and your church is still here today. Satan may, in a similar way, try to destroy you by casting you into anger or into alcohol. He may try to destroy you by casting you into pride or into pornography, by casting you into bitterness or betrayal, into wealth that can destroy you, or poverty that can destroy you. But destruction is his goal. And don't lose sight of that. Because when you recognize that Satan intends to destroy you and this church and this community, it utterly changes that first point about faith of who am I trusting in? Because this battle is a lot bigger than one I can win on my own. There's other frailties that are listed here. There's a doubt-ridden dad. He says, "I believe, help my unbelief." He feels his own frailty. Maybe you want your kids to grow up and love Jesus and serve their community and be hardworking people who provide for others and make radical sacrifices for the gospel, and yet at the same time, you've got doubts yourself. Why isn't God acting here? Why isn't he acting there? This man can relate to you. He says, I get frailty as a dad when I don't understand how all this is fitting together, but I want Jesus to do something about it. Frailty is not even limited to the parents in the room. The disciples, they're the power depleted guys. They're like, Jesus, what's going on? They go in private. They say, what happened? We used to be able to do this stuff. Do you see this on these pages? The Bible is like the most realistic book you can ever read. It's brutally honest about our frailty and how it hits us in different spaces. And I want you to recognize this too. Jesus doesn't despise your frailty. He doesn't despise your frailty. In fact, is that not what the message of Christmas is? Not only do I see your frailty and write a book about it so you'll understand it, I'll come to you in the frailest of all forms as a little baby so that you will know whatever frailty you're feeling, I understand it and I have embodied it and I love you. Oh, it's good. And we know the best friends draw near in difficulty, don't they? Think back to a difficult time in your life. And if you had the gift of a friend who drew near in that difficulty, I guarantee you right now you can see their face and remember their name. And if you didn't have that gift, oh, do you wish there was just someone there to sit next to you and drink a cup of coffee, even if they couldn't fix a thing, because the best friends draw near in difficulty. And the best lessons are learned in frailty as well, aren't they? That's why the Apostle Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 9, says God's power is made perfect in weakness. It works best in weakness. It's in our frailty that the best friends draw near and God's best lessons are learned. It is important when we talk about frailty that we point out one important fact. Frailty and the suffering of this world is sometimes a result of sin, but not always a result of sin. Or at least your personal sin. It's part of living in a sin-cursed world. But because you're dealing with a deep ditch and deep suffering today doesn't mean that God is judging you for sin. It's important we understand that. And by way of example, let me just remind you of Charles Spurgeon, the greatest preacher of the 19th century. He's called the Prince of Preachers, preaching in London. I'll tell you a bit about Spurgeon. He suffered from smallpox, from gout, chronic arthritis, inflamed kidneys. His wife was bedridden for decades. And of Spurgeon's last 22 years of pastoral ministry, seven out of 22, he was unable to preach because he suffered so deeply. So perhaps a season of suffering is a result of your own sin, but it might be Satan's desire to destroy you and to destroy Charles Spurgeon, like he tried to destroy the boy in this passage. And yet, listen to Spurgeon's own words as he describes this. And I especially want you to listen in closely here if you're in a dark and difficult season and hear from a man who suffered greatly and the Lord brought him through it on the other side. Listen to what Spurgeon says. He said, I'm afraid that all the grace I have got of my comfortable and easy times and happy hours might almost lie on a penny. But the good I've received from my sorrows and pains and griefs is altogether incalculable. Affliction is the best book in a minister's library. The good he received from all his sorrows, pains, and griefs, and they were not light pains, sorrows, or griefs, was incalculable. Of course, Spurgeon clung to this book as the best book in his library, but in a metaphorical and proverbial sense, he said, this affliction is the best book in my library. And you might expand that beyond a minister's library, just to say a Christian's library. Good news, guys. Frailty isn't the final word. God is bringing us into his fullness through it. So we've said faith is the only bridge from our frailty into Christ's fullness. Into Christ's fullness. Right as the story ends, verse 29, Jesus says, Only prayer can cast this kind out. And then he takes a sharp change in verse 30. And it's kind of odd. Like, what's going on? Why does Jesus say what he says in verse 30? It seems utterly unconnected to what just happened. You read it and you're like, is that supposed to be for next week? No, I'm pretty confident that section goes right where it does for a reason. Let's read it and then we'll talk about it. Verse 30 through verse 32. They went on from there and passed through Galilee. And he didn't want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they didn't understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. Jesus predicts his death and resurrection. And I believe it's strategically placed by Mark right here to help us understand what just happened. Why is that? Jesus' mission to get to the cross so that he could defeat once and for all sin and death and Satan. He's fiercely committed to that mission. And he knows when his mission is complete, his victory is won, then fullness of life will be born. That's what Jesus knows. There will be no more sin, no more sorrow, no more pain. Every tear will be wiped away. I can't wait for that day. There will be no more injustice. Or to put it in the context of this story, there will be no more demon-possessed men, no more doubt-ridden dads, no more power-depleted disciples, because Jesus has given life, he has given faith, and he has given power to the weak. Jesus knows when my victory is won, all those realities will not just be things we preach about and look forward to, but embody and know in a full way. And this fullness that Jesus has in view, I'm getting to the cross because that's my mission, wasn't just for a few first century people in the Middle East. No, Jesus intends that fullness of joy for every person who will place their faith and trust in him, who will surrender to him. How can that be possible for everyone when he can't come and touch every person like he did that guy? By getting to the cross to offer forgiveness for all sin, for all people who would come to him in faith. Maybe let me say it this way. Jesus wasn't merely a one-generation healer. He was the every-generation Savior and is the every-generation Savior. So that you can have a forgiven life free of guilt, a power-filled life to obey Jesus, and a certainty of eternal life with him. There's this huge ironic twist going on here, I think. You recognize that Jesus was up on the mountain, glory revealed, here's the Son of God, people with him. He comes down off the mountain and enters into a sin-cursed, chaotic, evil space. Arguments, demon possession, doubt, power depletion, all of that, right? If you look at the grand scope of the Bible, I think you have a mirroring here of the book of Exodus in chapter 32. Moses up on the mountain, glory revealed, 10 commandments given. Once in a lifetime spiritual moment, comes down off the mountain into sin-cursed, chaotic, evil wickedness. This is the story where God's people had said, how about we make a golden calf? That'll save us. We'll trust in ourselves. Sound a little familiar? Look at what happened in Exodus 32. See it on the screen here. This is Moses' interaction with God after he comes down off the mountain. And the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it's a stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone that my wrath may burn hot against them and I may consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. My wrath burns against rebellion and sin and wickedness. Remember, Mark 9 started out very similar. Mountain, glory, incredible, come down. People rebel, unbelief. How long will this go on? Exodus 32, God says, my wrath will consume them. Mark 9 is different. How long will this go on? How long will I be with this generation? And Jesus says, no, God's wrath won't consume you. I'll go to the cross so that God's wrath will consume me. So that I'll die for you. So that you can be forgiven. And I'll be raised so that you too can be raised. Don't you see the twist in the whole story? He says, it's been building and I have come not only to live the life you couldn't live, but also to die the death you should have died. So that on the basis of that finished work of Jesus, I could say, stand here and say to all who are here, who are weary and need rest, to all who are here mourning and longing for comfort, to all who feel worthless and wonder if God even cares, to all who fail and desire strength, to all who sin and need a Savior, this church opens wide her doors with a warm invitation from the Lord Jesus Christ himself, who says, enter the fullness of joy and my resurrected life and the power to live in obedience to my commands that is yours through faith. Faith is the only bridge from our frailty to Christ's fullness. Will you respond and trust him and no longer trust yourself? Let's pray.